Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson, and we are here to bring you the federal news update for Monday, November 24th, 2025.
And I'm Sam Kennedy.
Today, we are undertaking a really intense deep dive. We're focusing on a critical 72-hour window.
Right.
It spans from the beginning of Saturday, November 22nd, right through the close of business today, Monday, November 24th, 2025.
And our mission really is to provide you with a thorough, comprehensive analysis of what we believe was a genuine watershed period for American policy.
It really was.
I mean, when we synthesize all the sources, we're talking diplomatic cables, DHS operational reports, court orders, the sheer volume and the synchronization of these actions was just impossible to ignore.
Yeah.
This wasn't just a busy news cycle. This felt different. This was the moment when the America First Doctrine moved from, you know, political rhetoric into a full operational reality.
Across every branch of government.
Every single one.
That's the core thesis we identified. And it really organizes everything we're going to discuss today. We saw this coordinated dual strategy playing out.
Exactly.
On one hand, you have a conscious and I'd say aggressive retreat from traditional multilateral commitments abroad. We're calling that retrenchment.
And on the other hand,
an equally aggressive expansion and fortification of executive authority right here at home.
Mm.
And that's fundamentally changing bureaucratic and even constitutional norms.
And I think the key thing for you, the listener, to grasp is that the actions taken in this 72-hour period seem designed to be, well, irreversible.
Right.
They don't just shift policy. They're trying to restructure state power, both at home and on the world stage.
So understanding this dual-track retrenchment abroad, fortification at home, it's absolutely essential for understanding where U.S. governance is headed.
It is.
Okay, let's unpack this. Let's start with the international sphere, because the geopolitical earthquake that came out of Geneva was, without a doubt, the highest stakes activity of the entire weekend.
No question. We're talking about a frantic pace of negotiations.
All aimed at resolving the Russia-Ukraine war and doing it by Thanksgiving 2025.
The urgency was, you know, it was artificial, but it was relentless. It was driven by the administration's very clear goal: end the conflict, stabilize the global markets, and just cut the military and financial drain on U.S. resources.
It was a very sharp pivot.
An immediate one. You saw this move away from the longstanding strategy of support as long as it takes to one they're now explicitly, and I mean explicitly, calling peace through realism.
And the centerpiece of this new approach was what's now become the infamous 28-point America First peace doctrine.
Right. And this wasn't just some vague proposal floated out there.
No.
The reporting suggests this was a near final draft. It was developed with significant involvement from the U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff, working alongside Russian representatives. It effectively restructured Ukraine's very existence.
The detail in this blueprint is really what shocked diplomatic circles. It demands this intrusive fundamental change to Ukraine's internal structure, its external security.
Yeah.
Everything.
We have to start with the most painful provision for Kyiv, which is, of course, the territorial disposition.
Yeah.
The plan requires Ukraine to formally cede the Donbas region and, crucially, the Crimean Peninsula.
But this is where the analysis becomes, well, strategically catastrophic. And our sources really highlight this. The plan doesn't just address the territories that Russia already annexed back in 2014 or 2022.
No, it goes further.
It mandates freezing the conflict along the current active front lines. We're talking areas like Kherson and Zaporizhia Oblast. So why is that specific geographical detail so absolutely devastating?
Because that freeze cements Russia's strategic victory in perpetuity. I mean, it's that simple. It guarantees implicit Russian control over the critical land bridge. And for you, the listener, if you haven't been cracking the geography closely, this is the strip of territory along the Sea of Azov that physically connects mainland Russia to the Crimean Peninsula.
And by securing this, Moscow gets what it's always wanted.
They get logistical independence for Crimea. They completely eliminate Ukraine's access to the Sea of Azov. And maybe most importantly, they solidify Russian control over major industrial hubs.
And we have to be specific about those hubs. This plan locks in Russian control over Mariupol.
Yes.
A city that was once Ukraine's main maritime export gateway. A center for steel, for heavy industry.
Precisely. And that loss doesn't just represent territory. It fundamentally compromises Ukraine's long-term economic viability. Its ability to function as a major exporting state is just gone.
So this single provision, this freezing of the current lines, it moves way beyond a simple political surrender.
Oh, it imposes economic disarmament. That's what it is.
So moving from the geography to the military capacity, the proposal dictates a radical downsizing of Ukraine's ability to defend itself.
It does. It imposes a hard cap on the armed forces of Ukraine, the AFU, at 600,000 active personnel.
And what does that number actually signify? I mean, in terms of military realism, what does 600,000 troops mean?
Well, it transforms the AFU. To give you some context, before the February 2022 invasion, Ukraine's active and reserve forces were significantly larger, and their wartime mobilization has certainly pushed them over 1 million personnel.
So 600,000 is a huge cut.
It's a massive cut. And when you spread that number across the entire front line, which you have to remember stretches thousands of kilometers, including the borders with Russia and Belarus, it is simply not enough.
Not enough for what?
It's not enough for offensive maneuver warfare, and it's certainly not enough to repel a sustained large-scale invasion. Military analysts we've seen are universally describing this cap as reducing the AFU to a constabulary force.
A constabulary force. So they can police internally, maybe conduct some static defense, but they cannot independently defend against a new major push from Moscow.
It's an effective guarantee of external dependence.
And that's the goal.
That is the deliberate consequence. And this cap is tied directly to the ultimate Russian war aim, which is the explicit demand that Ukraine swear off any future NATO membership.
So this provision fulfills a strategic objective Russia has had since at least 2014.
It completely reverses two decades of Western policy aimed at fostering Euro-Atlantic integration for Kyiv. This is the very definition of retrenchment. The U.S. is unilaterally withdrawing its political leverage over Ukraine's entire long-term security architecture.
And then there are the more insidious cultural and political components that are embedded in the document, this internal restructuring.
This is the stick, right? This is the stick used against Kyiv. The plan mandates recognizing the Russian language as an official state language. Mm-hmm. And beyond that, it requires granting formal status to the Russian Orthodox Church, the Moscow Patriarchate.
Which essentially reverses decades of effort by Kyiv to separate its religious and cultural identity from Moscow's political influence.
It does. Kyiv views these provisions not just as policy shifts, but as providing the legal and cultural infrastructure for future Russian political influence operations.
What they call hybrid warfare tools.
Exactly. It forces this internal concession that just fundamentally undermines national unity.
Okay, so that's the stick. Now, the carrot. And it's a big one, but it's aimed at Moscow, not Kyiv.
It's a substantial one. The plan promises the lifting of all major sanctions on Russia and its readmission to the Group of Eight, the G8.
And the stated geopolitical logic behind this is absolutely crucial.
It is. The administration believes that by reintegrating Russia economically, it can detach Moscow from Beijing. It's an attempt to drive a wedge between the two authoritarian powers.
So it's this massive diplomatic and financial reward for Russian aggression, but it's being framed as a long-term strategic play against China.
That's the framing.
And these were the uncompromising terms presented by the U.S. delegation, led by Secretary of State Marco Rubio, which convened in Geneva on Sunday, November 23rd.
And the composition of that delegation really signals the weight of these negotiations. You had Rubio leading, but he was flanked by the Army Secretary, Daniel Driscoll, and the plan's architect, Special Envoy Steve Witkoff.
But the context was toxic, to say the least.
It was. President Trump spent the days leading up to the summit engaged in this very public pressure campaign, essentially demanding Kyiv accept the terms by the holiday.
And the rhetoric was highly coercive. I mean, specifically describing Ukraine as showing zero gratitude for previous aid.
It was all designed to achieve maximum isolation for President Zelensky, to frame any resistance to the 28-point plan as just personal stubbornness against the will of the American people.
And yet, after the talks, the joint statement that came out described the discussions as highly productive.
And that dissonance is where you have to really deconstruct the diplomatic language.
Right.
Phrases like fully uphold Ukraine's sovereignty become almost meaningless in this context.
If sovereignty's upheld, but you're forced to give up territory and cap your military, the word has been completely redefined.
Exactly. The analysts we've seen concluded that sovereignty in that communique means little more than the survival of the state entity.
Just that the state of Ukraine continues to exist on a map.
But its territorial integrity, its functional independence are fundamentally compromised. They also noted the phrase meaningful progress toward aligning positions.
which likely means what?
It probably means Ukraine conceded on the principle of permanent neutrality and giving up on NATO, but remained completely deadlocked on the physical cession of territory.
And the fascinating piece of political theater was the mandated inclusion of gratitude.
Oh, yes.
The communique required an explicit expression of thanks to President Donald J. Trump personally.
That detail alone confirms the atmosphere of coercion. It forced Kyiv to publicly smooth over that zero gratitude friction, whether they genuinely felt it or not.
That requirement was a U.S. precondition. A direct operationalization of a political grievance into a diplomatic necessity.
But the plot thickened dramatically on Monday, November 24th. And this led to a profound transatlantic rupture. Europe mobilized immediately.
They were completely blindsided.
They were. The European powers, we're talking the UK, France, and Germany, they released an alternative framework, a parallel track, because they viewed this U.S.-Russian drafting process as, well, catastrophic for European security.
And that European counterproposal is a crucial intervention because it gives Kyiv leverage.
So much leverage. Let's look at the key differences. On territory, they insisted that any negotiations over cession should only begin after a verified ceasefire is in place.
So that denies Russia the immediate political win of getting its annexations legitimized, which is what the U.S. plan demanded.
It demands de-escalation first.
Then there's the military strength discrepancy. The U.S. plan says 600,000 personnel. The European proposal offered a significantly higher troop cap of 800,000.
And that 200,000-person difference is a world apart in military terms.
It's the difference between just being able to hold a defensive line and actually having reserves for limited countermaneuvers.
Exactly. And furthermore, the European text refused to permanently close the door on NATO membership. It basically said that while consensus for membership isn't there right now, the theoretical path to integration remains open. It maintains hope.
And the financial rebuke was just direct. The U.S. plan offers the carrot of lifting sanctions on Russia.
Right.
The European counterproposal explicitly called for the frozen Russian assets, we're talking hundreds of billions of dollars, to be used directly for Ukrainian reconstruction.
And this is why that European intervention is so crucial for you, the listener, to understand. It means President Zelensky doesn't have to just reject the American plan and face total isolation.
He now has a viable, powerful, diplomatic alternative.
Backed by London, Paris, and Berlin. This diplomatic cover allows him to reject the most toxic, the most strategically damaging aspects of the U.S. proposal without risking a complete break with the West.
And the ripple effects of this hit Washington immediately. The bipartisan Congressional Ukraine Caucus, led by Republicans like Brian Fitzpatrick and Democrats like Marcy Kaptur and Mike Quigley, they issued a blistering statement.
They called the 28-point plan unacceptable. They condemned it as demanding the surrender and capitulation of Ukraine to Russian aggression.
And the unity of that Republican-Democrat opposition shows that this America First retrenchment strategy is not universally supported, even within the president's own party structure.
Not at all. They even framed this land for peace deal as an insult to Holodomor Remembrance Day, connecting the forced territorial cession to these historical tragedies.
The Geneva framework perfectly illustrates that retrenchment element of the new doctrine. But while the U.S. was aggressively inserting itself into the peace process there, it was simultaneously committing a historic act of withdrawal somewhere else.
This is the second pillar of the retrenchment strategy, the willful abandonment of diplomatic platforms based purely on domestic ideological narratives.
And you're talking about the U.S. decision to boycott the G20 summit in South Africa.
Which also ran from November 22nd through the 24th.
This action was completely unprecedented for a major G20 power. And the stated rationale cited by the administration was deeply, deeply controversial.
It was. President Trump accused the South African government of enacting racist anti-white policies and specifically cited the alleged persecution of white Afrikaner farmers as the official reason for not attending.
This detail is pivotal. For listeners who might be unfamiliar, the narrative of white genocide and the persecution of Afrikaner farmers is a conspiracy theory that circulates primarily in, you know, far-right online spaces.
And by citing this as the formal reason for boycotting the G20, the U.S. elevated a fringe, politically motivated grievance into formal U.S. foreign policy.
It was an attempt to completely delegitimize the host, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, over an internal cultural battle based on American ideological fault lines.
Exactly. And the mechanics of the boycott were designed to inflict maximum diplomatic insult.
Right, because the U.S. was the incoming host for the G20 in 2026, and was supposed to participate in the ceremonial handover of the presidency.
But instead of sending Secretary of State Rubio, who was busy in Geneva, or even another cabinet-level representative, the White House designated a mid-level diplomat from the U.S. Embassy in Pretoria.
The ultimate snub.
It was a calculated insult to the entire institution.
And South Africa responded accordingly. President Ramaphosa publicly refused to participate in the handover ceremony with this junior representative. He called the gesture an insult to the G20 process itself.
Which effectively broke the chain of continuity for the G20, creating a significant structural crisis for the group's leadership.
The political vacuum was immediate, and it led to what we're calling absentee hegemony.
Right. Because even though the U.S. wasn't there, it still tried to exert control. At the 11th hour, Washington sent these communications trying to block the summit's final declaration.
What were they objecting to specifically?
Primarily two things. One, strong, actionable language on aggressive climate change targets. And two, language promoting global wealth redistribution.
Which the administration views as an unacceptable challenge to national economic sovereignty.
They demanded that the climate language be watered down and the redistribution language be eliminated entirely.
But without U.S. negotiators actually present to leverage trade-offs or make threats or compromises.
The remaining G19 nations just adopted the declaration over U.S. objections.
They issued a final communique, essentially telling Washington that they would proceed without its input.
And the strategic implication here is critical for the global order. By withdrawing, the U.S. didn't stop global consensus from forming. It just removed its own veto power, its own ability to shape that consensus.
It signaled clearly to the global South and the other major economies that they could, and they would, bypass Washington entirely when the U.S. takes an ideologically obstructionist stance.
It's a picture of diplomatic chaos.
It is. And yet, this high-level ideological freeze contrasts so sharply with continued military engagement on the continent. It shows this bizarre split in U.S.-Africa policy.
This is the dissonance we observed. While diplomacy was frozen, kinetic operations continued. Specifically, on November 22, 2025, U.S.-Africa Command, AFRICOM, conducted a precision airstrike.
This was against ISIS Somalia terrorists in the Golis Mountains region of Somalia.
Right. And AFRICOM, for you, the listener, is the U.S. combatant command responsible for military operations and relations with 53 African nations. It's the operational arm.
So this airstrike, which was coordinated with the fragile central government of Somalia, it just highlights the strategic split.
It really does. The U.S. is willing to ideologically boycott a stable democracy like South Africa over culture war narratives, while at the same time maintaining deep, continuous, and vital security cooperation with a fragile state like Somalia, where immediate counterterrorism interests are at stake.
It's a foreign policy managed by contradiction.
It is.
And as the global stage showed this retrenchment, the domestic front showed aggressive fortification.
And this shift takes us directly into that aggressive expansion of executive authority at home. It was exemplified by the militarization of immigration enforcement deep in the U.S. interior.
The weekend of November 22nd through the 24th was the culmination of a large-scale pilot program called Operation Charlotte's Web.
This operation in Charlotte, North Carolina, used a surge strategy that paired agents from U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, with, and this is the critical part, agents from U.S. Customs and Border Protection, CBP.
The scope was huge. By the end of the weekend, federal agents had arrested over 250 individuals in the Charlotte metro area.
And DHS focused their public statements on making sure people knew they were targeting what they called the worst of the worst. Criminal aliens with prior convictions or outstanding final removal orders.
Let's look at the arrest profiles that DHS released to the media to shape this narrative.
The examples were very specific and designed to underscore a threat. You saw the arrest of Walter Jose Swivel, who had a final removal order from 2022 and prior convictions for domestic violence and assault.
There was Carlos Torres Antonio, arrested on charges including DWI and assault with a deadly weapon.
And Leonel de Jesus Chinchi Galvin, who faced aggravated assault and additional DWI charges. This sustained focus was clearly aimed at maximizing public support for the operation.
But the real tactical innovation, the mechanism that signals this domestic fortification, wasn't who was arrested, but who was doing the arresting.
Exactly. We're talking about the deployment of CBP agents, specifically Specialized Border Patrol Tactical Units, BORTEC, into a major city hundreds of miles from the southern border.
And this is the critical legal loophole being exploited. The fundamental question is, how is Border Patrol operating deep inside North Carolina?
The answer lies in 8 U.S.C. Section 1357.
That's the statute that gives Border Patrol agents their broad enforcement authority.
Yes, and the crucial language in that statute grants them authority within 100 miles of any external boundary.
And this isn't just the land border with Mexico or Canada. It includes the entire coastline, the Atlantic, the Pacific, the Gulf.
And Charlotte, North Carolina, falls well within the 100-mile zone of the Atlantic coast.
So by deploying CBP's elite, tactically trained units like BORTAC into this zone, the administration gets around the chronic manpower shortages that have traditionally limited ICE's interior enforcement capacity.
It's a sophisticated mechanism to bring border-level paramilitary enforcement capability directly into suburban and urban American environments.
It absolutely militarizes interior enforcement.
And the psychological component of this operation was almost as impactful as the arrests themselves. DHS seemed to be actively cultivating a state of operational ambiguity.
We saw local officials like Charlotte Mayor Lyles and Sheriff McFadden announce the operation's conclusion on November 20th. Probably hoping to calm the community.
But then DHS Assistant Secretary Tricia McLaughlin publicly contradicted them on November 23rd. She stated plainly, "The operation is not over and it is not ending anytime soon."
And that public contradiction just shattered any sense of security or predictability.
That ambiguity led to a community-wide paralysis. We have anecdotal reports of the ripple effect stretching far beyond immigrant neighborhoods.
Like businesses in affluent areas. We saw a report about pasta and provisions in Myers Park, reporting significant labor shortages because staff, fearing raids, simply didn't show up.
It shows how federal policy reaches into the non-immigrant economy almost immediately.
And previous softer enforcement efforts tended to be confined to specific known areas.
Right. But during Operation Charlotte's Web, there were reports of agents spotted near country clubs, shopping centers, even churches.
This expansion of visible enforcement shattered the implicit understanding that certain areas were safe zones, maximizing the deterrent effect.
And with Charlotte deemed a success, the administration immediately pivoted to its next target, sanctuary jurisdictions.
On November 24th, Border Czar Tom Homan announced plans for a widespread dragnet across New York City in the near future.
And to prepare for this massive enforcement action, the Department of Justice took a crucial legal step on that same day, November 24th. They published an updated official list of sanctuary jurisdictions.
And this is not just a naming and shaming exercise.
No, not at all. The list explicitly names states New York, California, Illinois, and major cities, NYC, Chicago, San Francisco.
So why is this list so legally important?
Because it's the formal precursor to enforcement actions under Executive Order 14287, which targets jurisdictions that refuse to cooperate with federal immigration authorities.
And the primary strategy here is financial coercion. The DOJ is setting the stage to withhold crucial federal grants.
We need to clarify what grant money we are talking about. It's the BYR and JAG funding.
The Edward Byrne Memorial Justice Assistance Grant.
Yes. Or J. It's the primary source of federal funding for local law enforcement programs. We're talking officer training, new technology, drug courts, gang prevention.
And losing that money, which could be tens of millions of dollars for a major city, would cripple local law enforcement capabilities.
It would. And the targeting of NYC is deeply symbolic. If you can dismantle the sanctuary status of the nation's largest city, it would be a definitive declaration of victory for federal enforcement power over local police discretion.
That successful, aggressive fortification on the streets of Charlotte and the legal preparation for NYC leads us directly into the quiet, strategic dismantling happening in Washington itself.
Right. The domestic fortification isn't just boots on the ground, it's also happening through calculated bureaucratic fragmentation.
The systematic deconstruction of the administrative state.
Starting with the Department of Education.
The administration had campaigned on abolishing the Department of Education, but that proved too politically difficult. So this new tactical pivot was revealed in a leaked recording on November 24th from Education Secretary Linda McMahon.
McMahon explicitly instructed her staff to abandon the toxic rhetoric of closing the department. She mandated the adoption of a far more palatable, politically neutral phrase, returning education to the states.
So it rebrands dismantlement as devolution.
Precisely. And the mechanism for this return is bureaucratic fragmentation. McMahon announced the phased movement of 6 specific offices out of the Department of Education and into other existing agencies like the DOJ or the Treasury Department.
And this is a highly technical but very strategic move.
It is. The goal is to dissolve the department's cohesive power without requiring a single difficult legislative act of abolition.
Is this an example?
Okay, so imagine moving the Office for Civil Rights, which enforces Title IX and non-discrimination laws, out of education and into the Department of Justice.
But if the Office for Civil Rights is moved to DOJ, doesn't it keep its function?
Technically, yes.
Yeah.
But it loses its singular focus. It loses its direct budgetary connection to education policy. By scattering these vital functions like student loan administration to Treasury or civil rights enforcement to DOJ, the administration can claim the functions are preserved while the institution loses its central coordinating power.
Its advocacy voice, its administrative control.
It's death by a thousand cuts.
And to sell this dramatic devolution, McMahon simultaneously launched the Returning Education to the States tour.
Right. A public relations and political campaign designed to build bottom-up consensus by engaging directly with state legislatures and local school boards.
So they're mobilizing local political support to advocate for the federal department's own demise.
It's operationalizing federalism to achieve an ideological goal. And meanwhile, the Treasury Department, under Secretary Mnuchin, was aligning itself tightly with the rest of this America First agenda, showing this whole-of-government approach.
On the foreign policy side, Treasury acted as a sort of counterbalance to the Ukraine policy.
They did. They tightened sanctions on Iran's oil network just a few days earlier on November 20th.
And that is highly significant.
It is. If the administration is about to lift sanctions on Russia, a move that would inject Russian crude back into global markets, they need to show that sanctions are still a viable tool against adversaries.
So tightening the screws on Iran's oil exports serves that purpose?
It signals a sophisticated use of sanctions as a scalpel. You remove them for one geopolitical objective with Russia, and you intensify them against a different adversary, Iran.
And domestically, Treasury aligned with DHS. They took regulatory action to prevent abuse of refundable tax credit benefits by illegal aliens.
This action brings the financial regulatory power of the Treasury Department directly into the Interior Enforcement agenda. By targeting access to tax credits, they're creating a financial pressure point on immigrant communities that complements the kinetic enforcement of Operation Charlotte's Web.
It is truly a systematic effort across departments.
It is.
Now we have to address where all this aggressive executive action generated the most friction. The stress points on the constitutional system itself, starting with the judiciary.
On November 22, 2025, the Supreme Court issued a pivotal order about the 2026 congressional redistricting map in Texas. Justice Samuel Alito issued a temporary administrative stay,
which effectively blocked a lower court ruling that has struck down the map.
And the background here is that this map was drawn to heavily favor Republicans. It could potentially grant the GOP 5 additional House seats in 2026. And the lower court found strong evidence of racial gerrymandering.
So the Supreme Court's use of the stay is what really matters here.
Yes. They invoked the Purcell principle. And for you, the listener, Purcell normally states that courts should avoid changing election rules too close to an election because it can cause chaos.
Right.
What's unprecedented here is that the court invoked Purcell even though the 2026 general election is still a full year away.
So by using a principle designed for immediate election stability to defer judgment a year out, what's the practical implication?
It effectively locks in the GOP's structural electoral advantage in Texas despite the grave claims of racial discrimination. It shows the court's willingness to prioritize deference to state legislatures over addressing immediate claims of partisan and racial gerrymandering.
It's a profound shift.
It is.
Now, let's pivot to the second major constitutional flashpoint of the weekend, the sedition crisis. A direct, explosive clash between the executive and the legislature concerning the military.
This crisis started with a preemptive action by Democratic lawmakers who are also military veterans. Specifically, Senator Mark Kelly and Representative Jason Crow.
They released public statements and internal messages advising military personnel that they are not obligated to follow illegal orders.
Which is a direct restatement of a fundamental principle enshrined in the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the UCMJ.
They were clearly trying to establish a firewall against the potential future misuse of the military for domestic purposes.
It was a preemptive move because that UCMJ principle is sacrosanct. Article 92 requires obedience to lawful orders, but it explicitly prohibits obedience to unlawful orders. This principle traces back through the Nuremberg trials. It's the cornerstone of military professional ethics.
And the president's reaction to this restatement of fundamental military law was immediate and extreme.
He publicly accused these sitting elected lawmakers of seditious behavior punishable by death.
I mean, that rhetoric is just a profound and dangerous degradation of democratic norms and institutional respect.
So when the commander-in-chief threatens members of the legislative branch with execution for simply articulating a bedrock principle of military ethics, what is the practical consequence for the military chain of command?
It creates an untenable crisis of dual loyalty for the military leadership, the generals, the admirals.
They're put in an impossible position. They have to uphold the letter and spirit of the UCMJ, which says unlawful orders must be refused, while at the same time serving an executive who is rhetorically threatening the lives of those who advocate for that same principle.
It forces the military to choose between legal obligation and political loyalty.
A choice that severely degrades the nonpartisan integrity of the armed forces. This is constitutional stress at its absolute peak.
And the syncretization of all these actions, the bureaucratic fragmentation, the partisan judicial deference, the threat to the legislature, it just highlights how quickly this fortification strategy is moving on multiple fronts.
And given these intense geopolitical maneuvers happening at the same time, especially the prospect of a Russia-Ukraine peace deal and lifting major sanctions, the markets reacted immediately and forcefully.
Particularly in energy and defense.
Right. The primary impact was felt in crude oil. The market immediately priced in the anticipated return of vast Russian energy exports, crude oil, natural gas, as part of that 28-point peace plan.
And that anticipation of increased global supply immediately depressed prices.
It reflected the end of the geopolitical risk premium that had sustained oil prices since 2022. WTI crude oil futures fell sharply to a one-month low, sitting at approximately $57.77 per barrel on Monday, November 24th.
This wasn't just a slight dip.
No, this was the market expressing confidence in the peace plan's ability to inject supply back into the global economy, even if the peace itself was harsh.
We also saw significant activity in the defense industrial base. Defense stocks experienced immediate volatility. They were caught between two competing forces.
On one hand, peace in Ukraine is inherently bearish for defense companies, especially those focused on expeditionary warfare, artillery, short-cycle ammunition, the supply chains that were supporting Kyiv.
So stocks reliant on high-volume, quick-turn production saw immediate dips.
They did. However, the administration quickly stabilized those concerns by signaling a fundamental pivot in the nature of defense spending.
And they did this by announcing a massive injection of domestic defense funding.
Detailing a $25 billion initial investment, which is part of a proposed $175 billion multi-year package, specifically aimed at building a domestic U.S. Iron Dome missile defense system.
So what does that strategic pivot mean for the market and for defense companies?
It's a clear signal. The defense industrial base is shifting its focus away from supporting foreign conflicts, expeditionary warfare, to what the administration is labeling fortress defense or homeland protection.
And this announcement immediately stabilized stocks like Raytheon, RTX, which specializes in missile tech, and Lockheed Martin, which builds interceptors and integrated defense platforms.
It ensures massive long-term domestic contracts to replace the short-term high-volume exports to Ukraine.
So the money doesn't just disappear. It gets redirected from global intervention to national fortification.
Exactly. And we did see some broader market reaction. The NASDAQ, which often reacts positively to lower oil prices because of lower input costs for technology, saw a modest bounce.
But the S&P 500 remained cautious.
It did. While the peace dividend was welcomed, the constitutional friction and the aggressive domestic enforcement moves created a lingering uncertainty for sectors dependent on predictable legal and political environments. Bond markets, anticipating lower inflation from cheaper oil, saw short-term yields decrease,
suggesting a cautious but generally accepting view of this new political economic reality.
Right. The economic consequences weren't just about oil, but about a structural reorientation of military spending toward homeland security and fortress defense.
As we conclude this exhaustive deep dive into the 72 hours spanning November 22nd through the 24th, the sheer scale of the coordinated actions is... It's truly staggering.
It is. We witnessed the full operational launch of a new American order defined by that dual strategy you laid out.
The retrenchment abroad was undeniable, sacrificing the territorial integrity and military self-determination of an ally in Geneva.
And sacrificing diplomatic stability by boycotting the G20 in South Africa based on domestic ideological grounds.
And this was seamlessly paired with aggressive fortification at home.
The militarization of interior enforcement using the 100-mile rule in Operation Charlotte's Web,
The strategic legal groundwork laid for sanctuary warfare in New York City, using the threat of cutting BIR and JAG funding.
And the quiet administrative dismantling of the Department of Education.
And at the same time, the constitutional checks and balances of the American system were pushed to points of maximum strain.
The executive openly threatened members of the legislature with accusations of sedition, testing the UCMJ's integrity.
And the Supreme Court provided that critical partisan deference on the Texas redistricting map, effectively locking in electoral advantage.
It was a watershed moment, a moment where policy was restructured to favor national closure and executive power over global engagement and administrative continuity. The period ended with the clear reality that America has redefined its commitment to the global order and its own internal governance structure.
And for you, the listener, we want to leave you with one final thought to mull over as you process the gravity of this new reality.
Okay.
Look back at the Geneva Framework. That 28-point plan included a U.S. security guarantee, a promise of a decisive, coordinated military response if Russia were to violate the peace treaty and reinvade.
And the central contradiction there is just stark. How can the U.S. offer a credible protective military guarantee to Ukraine while at the same time requiring Ukraine to disarm itself, to cap its military at a constabulary level, and to cede core strategically vital territory?
The reliability of that protective promise is inherently undermined by the administration's demand for unilateral disarmament.
It is.
The ultimate question defining this new doctrine is this. What does this dual reality offering a protective promise while simultaneously forcing surrender and self-weakening signal to existing U.S. allies in Europe and Asia, and crucially, to future adversaries about the long-term reliability and consistency of any American foreign policy commitment? That is the geopolitical risk you must now weigh as the full implications of this 72-hour period unfold.